Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every other week, two nerds get together to rate, read, and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm his bikini-wearing, sword-wielding best friend, Duncan Nichol.
First class, Duncan. First class introduction. That's right, because this week we are doing a tiny little departure from the main format, because we didn't actually read a fantasy novel this week, Duncan, did we?
No, we did not. We have stepped into the realm of fantasy comic books. I know, really going out there.
Now, of course, as I said last time, arguably have we done fantasy comic books, considering that we've done, like, five different episodes about Berserk?
We had this debate at the end of the last episode. I said, no, that's manga. You said, Duncan, there's no difference. Yeah,
that's how debates probably work. I remember the last time when there was a US presidential debate, and one of them said, you are not qualified to be president. And the other one said, I disagree. And they all left the room, and that was the end of it.
I mean, might as well have been, but good point. Yeah, you're right. There's no real, like, hard difference between a Western comic, a manga, a graphic novel. It is a, you know, it is a story with images which doesn't rely on prose to get across descriptions. There you go. That's my definition.
Now, Duncan, you chose for us to read Red Sonja, Queen of Plagues. Now, to my understanding, a slightly arbitrary choice in terms of where to start with reading Red Sonja. Obviously, you picked this because you were extremely excited about next week's release of the highly anticipated Red Sonja movie.
Yes, I am still super excited. Unfortunately, I will not be able to go and see it in cinemas because in the UK, it's not in cinemas. It's in a cinema. One. There will be one showing.
There is one. Yeah, it's not showings. It's showing. It's on one screen in one place at one time on one occasion. That's it.
To be fair, if we went, we could also meet the director while we're at it.
We certainly could. That would be one hell of an interview get, to be like, do you feel like this is a tremendous disappointment?
Hey, it's not out yet. We haven't seen it. This film could still rock that kind of cult. I don't know what the next word was going to be. Just people might still like it, you know. It could be one of those films that just super appeals to a very, 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 very small demographic of people. And I'm not going to lie,
this really could be the Van Gogh of sword and sorcery movies. In years to come, long after all the members of the cast and crew have killed themselves out of shame, it might be very well regarded.
Okay, mean. But we don't know yet. I'm still holding out hope, but my standards aren't high when it comes to sword and sorcery. It's not a genre that's set the bar particularly high. Before we actually get into
the start of the episode,
I know. Before we get into the comic, which we will discuss whether or not, well, why even bother doing an adaptation of Red Sonja again? Because there was a previous movie. Geordie, has there been anything non-Red Sonja related that you have read, experienced, watched, and you just want to share with us?
I gotta say, Duncan, you really took it easy on me this episode because your whole instruction was, please read this 100-page comic book in an afternoon, and you don't even have to pay for it because you can get it for free in Kindle Unlimited. So you really didn't ask a lot for me, and I appreciate that. And that meant I got to commit a lot of time to another book, because in between these episodes, I read and finished a real behemoth of a book. I read Under the Dome by Stephen King.
Ooh, famously parodied by The Simpsons. What's the original like?
It's pretty cracking. It's a really good book, to be quite frank. I had an absolute blast. It's all about a town that gets sealed under an impenetrable dome. Everyone gets stuck inside. Things start to fall apart. And view the slow motion train wreck of watching society crumble, like autocracy rise, violence break out, everything coming to ruin. It's really masterfully done. I've heard people describe this as the spiritual sequel to The Stand, and that's very well put, because I think something Stephen King obviously does very well is community horror. He's all about writing about groups of people, switching between perspectives and watching, you know, society crumble in a way that feels realistic enough to actually be unsettling. Be like, yeah, you know what? I feel like a lot of this is actually a feasible way of writing. People kind of starting to go a little bit crazy. The characters are great. It's funny. It's exciting. There are moments where, like, characters put together mysteries, and I literally punched the air because I was like, yes, you got it! You got it! And the sense of anticipation you can build. It's a really great book for suspense. There's only one moment where I went, huh? And that's pretty low for a Stephen King book. It's a pretty grounded book. It's very much more sci-fi as opposed to supernatural and fantasy. But at one point, a corgi, Horace, we're following his perspective, and a ghost tells him, hey, go pick up that thing and bring it to your master. And the narration very casually says, unlike all dogs, Horace often heard the voices of dead people. And it just throws it out there. It doesn't care. The book just says it and then moves on. He's like, what? Come on.
Geordie, whenever your dog starts barking, like, for no reason in the middle of the night, you now have your reason.
Duncan, people genuinely believe that. That's not even funny. There are people out there who genuinely believe that.
I just don't think we should use what some people genuinely believe as the bar. Because that would be so low. But I'm really glad you enjoyed it. And I really like the sound of that concept, Geordie. I would love to read a book like that. I think at the start of this year, I read a book called Nod, which is about most society can no longer sleep. And that's another book.
Yes, that's a good book. That is a great book.
I really enjoyed it because I really do like seeing society slowly crumble. In fact, whenever I read, like, zombie literature, that's often the element that's kind of the most fun. I actually prefer zombie outbreaks when it takes you through the initial outbreak rather than that lone man, you know, surviving in the wilderness. I think the initial crumbling is the infinitely more interesting story.
Something I was reflecting on this week as I was reading Under the Dome is that I believe one of the crowning achievements of the zombie genre is the Walking Dead comic book. TV show's crap, forget about that. The comic book is amazing. And that series' two main inspirations are 28 Days Later. That's pretty obvious why, because you jump right into the apocalypse happening. It's about group dynamics, it's about survival, it's about, oh, where will people go in order to survive? How will it change them? And the other main influence is The Stand by Stephen King, because it is about society collapses, but a new society, a strange, warped, changed society is going to take its place. And let's watch that happen very slowly and intricately.
I have not read all of The Walking Dead. I've only read, like, the first compendium, which takes us up to the end of, like, the prison arc. And I don't know why I never continued, because honestly, I loved it. Absolutely adored it from cover to cover.
And it only gets better. It genuinely just gets better. Like, there are dips, there are valleys. A lot of people don't like the ending. I think the ending's great. But it really, it just takes you to a lot of different places, that series. Duncan, in the meantime, stepping outside Stephen King and Zombos, have you been reading anything else this week?
Oh, I have been reading something else. And I read something else that ties so neatly into the main subject of this episode. Because, Geordie, I finally got round to actually reading Robert E. Howard's Shadow of the Vulture. Short story.
Okay.
Okay.
Tell me more.
Well, Geordie, this is technically, sort of, the first appearance of the character Red Sonja, spelled with a Y, not a J.
I see. Does it bear any resemblance whatsoever to the character that I would anticipate seeing in a comic book like this one?
I mean, considering that it's set during the 1529 Siege of Vienna, and she carries a dual set of pistols, and is Ukrainian. No, not a huge amount, to be honest. She does meet up with a towering northerner, a German guy, who is not Conan. And
sure,
she has an attitude. She likes a drink. She gets along well. They start off, she's like, what are you doing here? But then they get this sort of respect on the battlefield. And they sort of team up later on in the story. I really wanted to explore this because it's so kind of interesting, this character, how it's evolved over time. And this is the most often quoted origin point, and why in a lot of Red Sonja comics, they say things like the character created by Robert E. Howard. And I wanted to go back and reaffirm that that statement is an absolute load of bollocks. It is a lie. And it annoys the hell out of me. Should have been...
Okay.
Based on a character, or inspired by some writing spy, not a character by Robert E. Howard.
So, dear audience, anyone who's been listening to the podcast for a long time, or even just a handful of episodes, will know that Duncan really, really likes Conan the Barbarian by Robert E. Howard. It's sort of you're probably by default your favorite fantasy series. I hope I'm not going out on a limb there, Dunk.
It's certainly the only thing that comes close would be Discworld, but that is loved in such a different way, it's almost hard to compare.
And of course, you know, you've really flexed your expertise. I would consider you, Duncan, an actual expert on Conan the Barbarian. I don't think there are many people on the planet who really rival your knowledge of the canon, both what happens in the stories, but also the expanded writings. You did a whole episode about the fan fiction empire which sprung up after the death of Robert E. Howard and other authors took over. And to my understanding, as a layperson, the character of Red Sonja is someone who's been really important to the canon of Conan, but only long after the death of Robert E. Howard. I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm gonna stretch back, I'm going to look into my mind palace and try and remember a conversation you and I had in probably like 2017, where you explained to me how Red Sonja came to be. And I think she's from like a 1970s comic book adaptation of Conan the Barbarian.
You're completely correct. Well done.
Yeah! Take that, ADHD.
Yes, she is. So the character of Red Sonja, spelt with a J, a completely separate legal entity and separate copyright to Red Sonja of Rakotona, this is probably a real place as well. Red Sonja spelt with a Y.
I'm not even going to complain about that. Ukraine's been in the news a lot over the past couple of years, and it does have some rather tricky place names.
Spelt with a Y, which is a separate legal entity to this new one that was created for the comic book. The character we're going to discuss today was created by Roy Thomas and Bay Winter Smith in the pages of their Conan the Barbarian comic book. She was created to basically give a female foil for our noble barbarian. And essentially, they had two characters in Robert E. Howard canon. They had the character of Valeria and the character of Baylet. But because they were telling the story in a very much a chronological manner, you know, they're very limited to how much they could engage with those two characters. They wanted someone original that they could then fling in and out and work around the rest of the narrative. And Roy Thomas did say in an interview why he picked Red Sonja, because Baylet had black hair, Valeria was a blonde, and he thought this would make her unique. Go, Roy.
So he completed the Neapolitan ice cream.
That's definitely one way to put it. And the characters were most heavily inspired by that original character by Robert E. Howard, but also taking inspiration from other characters like Black Agnes by Robert E. Howard. And although Roy would never admit it because he did not have the rights, we on this podcast have covered J.L. Ajori, who is also a red-haired, sword-wielding woman who probably maybe had a little bit of influence here and there.
So yeah, what we're getting here is similar to like the many, many imitations of the character of Black Lightning in DC, where they like, we've got this character, but one particular writer, one creator has the rights to this character, so we have to create a bunch of different clones of him in order to be able to tell stories with, you know, a black superhero with lightning powers. That's why there are so many black superheroes with lightning powers. It's all because they're trying to get money, if you're trying to avoid giving money to the dude who invented Black Lightning, just so Jirel of Joyri gets to join in and the Conan of a Barbarian adventures. A feisty, red-headed barbarian who has a complicated relationship with men, where the narrative wants her to be saucy and in romantically charged situations, but where they can't quite have her merely submit to someone else's desires. So that's why Red Sonja has this whole deal of, I'll only be with someone who's physically stronger than me.
So that's a kind of a key element of the character that's been reimagined through the times. In fact, I actually went to the Red Sonja forums and did start a discussion about the definitive interpretation of Red Sonja. Because Red Sonja's been reinterpreted again and again and again, as you implied, by different writers. And sort of her backstory's been tweaked, the rules have changed, her characterization has changed, and it can be really hard to know, where do I even begin? And I hope in this episode we can kind of explore that a little bit. I can hand out some advice to our listeners, and then we can sort of analyse, is it even worth beginning? But what would you say, Geordie? You've read a Red Sonja now. Tell me a bit about her as a character.
I've read two Red Sonjas. Sure. So the interpretation that we're going through now is written by Gail Simone. Gail Simone is a pretty famous writer of comic books, probably best known for her Wonder Woman run in the New 52. She's also written... She really likes feisty sword and sorcery heroines. The start of this comic book, there was a letter written by Gail Simone where she says, like, you know, when I write superheroines, I still feel like I am writing sword and sorcery heroines. They're really baked into her literary DNA. And that really came across in this comic book. The things which I felt were changed this time were, one, she played much freer to explore the idea of Red Sonja being a sapphic character. You know, she exchanges a kiss with the antagonist of this story, who is a woman. That kind of makes sense, because when you have a chainmail bikini wearing warrior who often refuses to have relationships with men, you're probably going to naturally think, like, okay, well, maybe she's more interested in women than she is in men, actually. However, I wouldn't say I ever really have had a classic Red Sonja experience. The only two comic books of her I've ever read were both written by Gail Simone. They're both written in a sort of modern era of the character. I don't think I really got the full, unironic, bikini-wearing warrior character. I don't think I've experienced that.
No, and that is something that I do want to address, because Gail Simone's run even stands within the community as a bit of this antithesis to sort of the more benchmark interpretation of the character. Going back to sort of Roy Thomas's initial work and her appearance in Conan, sort of the kind of the key elements was she had this much stronger, well, it was actually like a religious vow of, like, I will not lie with any man who does not defeat me in combat. By the way, I think within that entire Marvel canon, Conan was the only one to do it, and then
he refused.
Afterwards, he pointed out to her that it said she cannot, doesn't mean she has to. And then it was
well done, Conan.
Yeah, I think the exact line he basically goes, "I'm not interested. If you're going to sulk about it, you can forget it." I actually thought it was quite nicely done.
I feel like that is genuinely a good way to handle that. Like, you want to play with the idea of this extremely feisty, strong, independent woman. If part of the baggage that is brought up with that is the idea, the misogynistic idea, that a woman sleeping with a man in some way lowers herself, and you want to have the character, the main male character, interact with that emotional conflict, pretty much the worst thing you could have him do is win that fight and then follow through on it. The idea that you get to have your main character stay on top, stay the big dog because he wins, but not do something that could be morally reprehensible, you know, coerce someone into a sexual relationship, I feel like, considering what you've set up, it's probably the best way to handle it.
I think it very much is. But this is what where the baseline is kind of set. So talking about the character, there are a few like true tenets that have always kind of stood true. True tenets that have stood true, yes. I like to repeat to myself. The character always starts with this sort of idyllic childhood. Quaint little farm, quiet village, and some people rock up and lots of death follows. And her idyllic life is completely torn asunder. And this is given different spins. Sometimes it's just her little family. Sometimes it's her whole town. Sometimes it's her whole kingdom. And some other spins are sometimes she loves the idyllic life and then it's torn down. Sometimes she's already bracing against it and is looking for that call to adventure. She, you know, she's waiting for her Luke Skywalker moment of coming back home, find them all dead and going, well, I guess I am off now. The other element that gets played with, and I do want to address this now, so sort of a content warning, it's not in the actual book that we are reviewing today, which is Queen of Plays by Gail Simone, but it is connected to a lot of interpretation of the character, and that is a depiction of sexual assault in this moment. It has come and gone. Some people seem to be really attached to it as a defining trait or a defining moment of her deciding to take up the sword. I don't think it actually does any more than just having her family murdered achieves. From a story standpoint...
Batman didn't need to be raped for him to become a cool hero. Why did it need to happen to a female character?
Completely. It is there in certain interpretations, not on this one today, but I think people, you know, need to be aware of that before they go off freely. The other element, which sort of is always there, is then after this event, she sort of takes this vow of, I'm going to take up the sword, I'm not going to be in this position again, and I'm going to fight against bad people, the type of bad people who do what they have done. Sometimes this is very literal. Sometimes there is a goddess that appears before her, and she takes a very paladin-y vow to defend the weak, and goes off like that. And sometimes it's just a commitment to herself.
So, Duncan, I've only had a couple of interpretations of Sonya, and in those, what I get the impression of is like, oh, she's sort of a reluctant hero. She's like, oh, I feel like I have to do this because these people are in need. Is she much more of a do-gooder than Conan? Because Conan will just sort of go on an adventure, show up somewhere, and then it's sort of like, flip a coin, and he's like, I'm fighting bad guys because it's the right thing to do, and I'm fighting these guys, and I do not care whether they're bad or not. I want the gold.
So, by and large, the interpretation is that Red Sonja is far more noble than Conan the Barbarian, particularly in the very first Dynamite run. They're the guys who had the license when after Marvel originally relinquished it. They have always done a bit more of a paladin take on Red Sonja. Now, the original version of Red Sonja by Marvel was a bit more mercenary like Conan. She's there for the gold, but she has her kind of, you know, the line she won't cross. But that has faded into the background. In fact, the first Dynamite run, Red Sonja, She-Devil with a Sword, I would almost characterise as being quite a bit more high fantasy than Sword and Sorcery, and really making Red Sonja this like paladin of vengeance. She is on a quest from a god to fight evil.
Okay, so that's a little bit of the history of Sonja. I've definitely learned a great deal now. Honing in on the version we just read, Red Sonja, Queen of Plagues. Now, to my understanding, Duncan, I'm going to assume that this is a bit of a reboot. You know, this is Gail Simone's first getting a handle on the character. And this is sort of her planting her flag and saying, okay, this is my mission statement for what I'm going to do with this character going forward. Is that right?
You are 100% correct. One main thing to know about the Dynamite Red Sonja is that every time a new writing team come in, they reset to issue one and they're like, this is a soft reboot. Continuity has stopped. In fact, they eventually put out something called Sonjaversal and just went, right, guys, it's a multiverse. Just, it just come is. On. Stop bothering us.
I mean, that definitely has to be the case for following the stories of Conan, because there are so many interpretations, and not even Conan historians can agree on what order the stories take place in. I'm looking at you, Road of Kings. But with this one, Gail Simone is putting her thumb on the scale, saying, okay, here's what we're going to do. This is my version of Red Sonja's origin. So we're going to have, you know, it's going to be on a 5 on the scale of how tragic the backstory is, but a 2 on the amount of sexual violence. And so we're introduced for the first time to the character of Red Sonja. And I would say she's in that, as I said before, that reluctant hero phase. She has a personal debt to this king who's city is in trouble, and the strong impression is, if she didn't have this personal connection, she really wouldn't care less. She comes to care for some of the characters who she interacts with during the story, and she gets invested over time, classic hero stuff, but it's only because there's this personal debt that she even shows up at all.
That's right, and I really like how this comic starts. I actually really enjoy the fact that we open on this like battle scene with this king kind of walking through, and he's throwing out lore tidbits which you don't really know the relevance for. They're like, the evil lord, he managed to escape, and the king's like, we'll hunt him down later. And they go through this like keep they've taken, and they work their way down, and they talk about, well, what of the prisoners that you have found here? And the guards are like, oh my liege, it's not pretty. And they open the door, and we just see these people in shadow chained up.
Like, all of them are dead.
Him, like, what are your names?
No, all of these people are dead. No one could have survived the suffering they've been through.
Except two. And one of those two, it's just several panels of like, they're like, what is your name? Like, and it's just like, I am, and it's like, I am Red Sonja. And then we jump forward. I think it's about three seasons.
They say 3 cycle of the seasons. So 3 years after, you know, she's had her time. She's done her Batman year one. She's got her groove going. She's now in I Am, the She-Devil with a Sword. And we reunite with her as she's being tracked down again on some other adventure. Being said, the king who saved you, he needs your help. It's us, 2 plucky heroines who have stars in our eyes, and we think you're totally badass, and we'd really like to be your friends. Would you come with us? Ugh, I guess I'll come with you after I've had my alcoholic drinks, because I'm cool.
All the way. This Red Sonja is much more, as you kind of established, she's much more down to earth. In many respects, I think she taps into more of that classic sword and sorcery hero aesthetic, because I don't think most classic sword and sorcery heroes go for the paladin look. You know, this is a true neutral good human fighter class.
Yeah, so you get a sense that like this is someone who she is in it for herself, but she's not wicked, she's not unkind, you know, she's impatient with these people she runs into. But the way we're introduced to her is, you know, a pretty utilitarian approach to the character. You're introduced with some thieves who are sneaking up on Red Sonja. They're going to steal her stuff, and, like, she threatens them, but she does it in this lazy way, which, like, she doesn't even get up, she just says, like, I've got a knife under my pillow, I'm gonna kill you guys if you come near me and take my stuff. Or, hell, actually, that's not even wrong. It's like, you can take my gold, you can't take my horse, but do not touch my alcohol, otherwise I will kill you. So, slightly heavy-handed, Gail Simone is laying down, like, okay, what are we interpreting about this character? Classic action movie stuff, like, very gruff, very callous, and yet, as the scene develops, after a fight does kick off, and she effortlessly kills all these people, she approaches the last one, who starts coughing up blood. He has the plague. Oh, this book, it's a book called Queen of Plagues. This must be important. And there's an interesting moment where she spares him. She doesn't kill him. She knows he's dying, and actually, she gives him her alcohol and says, you can have it. you know, you can have it and you know, celebrate your life before you go. So we're introduced right now, just really solid utilitarian approach to character writing. The character has a sort of exterior look. This is what they show to other people. They've spoken to some enemies, she's spoken to some allies, she's acting in a very gruff way, but when, you know, things get real, you can see that she opens up a little bit and you get to see some of the internal, softer, nicer parts. She's merciful to someone she knows is dying. And then she agrees to come off in the adventure because she's told, oh, it's that guy who you owe a great debt to. Okay, well, I'm an honourable person, so I will go.
I also really just like the fact that this is the directness of, this is my priorities as a character. Gold at the bottom, the ability to travel and do my job a second, and I like booze first. And then you take that sort of direct kind of priority list, and at the end of the scene she goes, oh, there's one thing more important than my booze, and that's being a decent person. It's like, cool, I get you. I know where we stand.
Right. Now I'm going to jump in and say something else. We've spoken about character, we've spoken about canon. Now we need to talk about medium. We're not reading a book this time. And I will point out, Duncan, as I did last time, you have very deliberately chosen a comic book. Because this year, Gail Simone, the same writer of this comic book, wrote a Red Sonja novel. And we're not reading that one. We're doing this instead. May I ask, why?
That's a really good question. So, one thing to say is that at the time, and from release media, I believe this comic book, this particular comic book, has been drawn on the most to inspire the upcoming feature film. But more importantly, this is a character created for and has lived and breathed within the pages of comic books.
Sure.
And I don't think it would be right, just because a pro story has been written, there's been Red Sonja pro stories in the past as well, that should somehow be more definitive or more worthy of our time over the medium that's given it, this character, life for so many years.
Okay.
Also, final point, it's Red Sonja, and don't you want to see that?
When you say that, are you referring to her breasts?
No, I'm referring to her, like, action and the it's like with Batman. You want to see his cape, like, actually see his cape billowing in the wind.
Well,
you want to see the cool designs and of his enemies. You want to actually see the fight scenes play out.
Okay, sure, I hear you.
It's a visual story.
Yeah. Here's the deal, though. It's not actually that good, is it? Like, in terms of art, in terms of the fights, they're not actually that exciting.
I'm not going to lie, compared to something like Berserk, this is not the most detailed.
Yeah.
I think a big component of that is probably time and sort of panel distribution. There isn't a lot of time given to the fights.
Yeah, the fights are...
in this particular Red Sonja.
Really over and done with. I mean, obviously that introductory fight is... it's just to show... you know, it serves a purpose, is to start the story off. But it's also the first introduction to Red Sonja as the badass heroine. So you feel like you'd really want to put on your A-game in terms of depicting fights. And it's, in the one hand, it is worth bringing up Berserk, because that's the only other reference we have for depicting action in a comic book form that we've discussed on this podcast. But to just to go slightly beyond that, you don't even need to go to Berserk, which is a masterclass in drawing compelling fight scenes.
Let's just be clear. As far as I'm concerned, and I'm waiting for the day someone shows me something else, Berserk is the perfect 10 out of 10, quite possibly the greatest example of drawn fight scenes ever produced.
The only thing I can think of that would even come remotely close would be Vinland Saga. But we can't discuss that because that is historical fiction, not fantasy. But it's very beautifully drawn. But to go beyond that, I'm looking at my bookshelf right now. I've just brought in a whole bunch of manga from my old house. I'm looking down the list. I've got One Punch Man. I can see Blue Exorcist. Even Blue Lock. And that's about football. All of those series have far superior action to anything you see in this particular comic book. But to go beyond that, in just like Western comic books as a whole, I find Western comic books' action to be extremely uncompelling. My favorite superhero comic book of all time is Invincible. That has some pretty great action scenes, but really the stuff around it is the storytelling. That's what makes it work. It's the humor, it's the sheer spectacle of some of the fights. And, you know, other great stuff like paneling. Everyone who's read A Fair Way into the Invincible comic book knows that the amazing way that paneling is used in, say, the Conquest fight, or when on the Bug Planet, or Throg versus Battle Beast. Those ones go for pure, overwrought spectacle. Like, we're going to just throw this great image of violence in montage. But the individual stick figures fighting back and forth are not that compelling. And they're definitely not even close to as compelling in this.
And I think you're probably right on that. I'm not going to stand here and actually defend this as the top tier of even the sort of sword and sorcery neck of the woods. I think what Dark Horse at a similar time to this was putting out in their Conan the Barbarian comic was superior.
I agree.
In terms of spectacle and action. Maybe it is a reflection, as you said, of to Western comics. I'm not going to lie, I've always had this issue, particularly around a lot of superheroes. Think Superman. I've not read a great deal of Superman, but how do you choreograph a fun fight scene when you've got a person who is often that much overpowered? Well, in fact, a lot of the images, it's just about him, like, focusing on his face, or the fact that he's trying to do multiple things at once, or, you know, it's him gritting through something, rather than complex step-by-step, you know, choreography.
I mean, that's definitely true. I don't want to say, though, that it's like, oh, when the characters get too powerful, it stops becoming compelling. Because, again, the stuff I have on my bookshelf, we have One Punch Man, which is like the character's so powerful, it's literally a joke. I've got My Hero Academia, which is like, in the last part of a series, the powers are completely insane. They're like jumping in between fighter jets to do their battles. The point is that that's not the priority when it comes to Western comic books. When you see, like, Wolverine get into a fight, it's normally just a big image of him, you know, claws out, yelling, and then just speech bubbles all around him, like monologues. And that's what they do. It's all about the characters, like, what they're thinking about at the time. It's not actually about characters using their powers in interesting ways in order to win the fight. It's not JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. That's not what a tradition of Western action comic books is really about. I do feel like this, you know, when you're trying to inherit the legacy of sword and sorcery, you probably should concentrate a little bit more on making the fights look kind of badass.
I'm inclined to agree. I definitely would love it if there was just a bit more given to actually showing us this character being a really capable fighter. Because one kind of issues I think we get quite a bit, particularly in like Red Sonja as a whole, is you'll get told about how Red Sonja is this one of the greatest fighters there ever been, the best swordswoman. And then what you'll often see is that first panel of like her standing there, hero pose, the enemy are running at her. And then there'll just sort of be this, you know, 3-4 cuts of her mid-fight, sword of swinging, blood spurting. And then it'll get, you know, you'll turn 2 pages and then she'll be standing there looking exhausted, surrounded by dead bodies. And that's the approach. Maybe some prose description and boxes of, you know, going, and the battle was legendary, and the fighting raged, but no one could touch her.
It's
something to that tune.
There's a limitation here on the story. And there are moments of action which work, and they tend to be ones which are more focused around character. So the highlights in this story for me are the montage of Sonja as a child hunting down the people who killed her family. you know, I felt like that really worked. That was really effective because it felt like it worked with the time scale. That was, it was montage. It was stretched out. So we're talking about a battle which takes 4 hours, written over 3 pages. Okay, that makes sense. The choppy nature of the way it's depicted. Her taking out one person at a time. Oh, a panel of her hiding, a panel of her climbing a tree, a carriage of her knocking an arrow, a panel of people falling down, someone getting their throat slit. That works really well. The other stuff which worked was when it just stopped being about the fighting. So her main antagonist is Anicia. At the end, when they're having their fight, it's not actually about the spectacle of them fighting. It's purely about the relationship between the characters being expressed by the fight. And that's where that works. When it's not about fighting, when it's about character.
So let's move on for the story then, and kind of meet these characters as we go along. After we establish, Red Sonja is recruited. She needs to go and see. I'm going to keep calling him the Good King. I feel Damas?
Baytraz is the evil king, right? I think his name is Demath.
And like, Demak is the good king. We meet the good king Demak at his kingdom, and it is saying how he is being wrecked by the plague. The plague has whipped through his lands. His army was almost all wiped out just by the plague alone. And now there's this marauding army that is progressing across the land, and he is beseeching Red Sonja to help him defend his kingdom.
I can see what you mean, Duncan, about when I asked you a while back about whether the Red Sonja book we're going to read was the one where she had to train an army to fight against a superior invading force, and you said, which one? Because the only two Red Sonja stories I read are by the same author and have the exact same premise. Red Sonja has to prepare an inferior force to defend against a more powerful invading army.
I'm literally flicking through my brain now, and I'm like, how many times has this actually happened? And I'll be honest with you, Geordie, I think I'm counting about 5.
Well, you don't want her to be on the side of the invading force with superior numbers. That's not very fair.
No, and it's always, you know, it's she comes to some sanctuary-like place and they're all like, but how could we possibly stand up to her? And she does a rousing speech, and it works. It's a trope, but I don't know why it keeps getting me. Probably more on how it just keeps getting me later. So she, after some funny scenes of her not liking to wear the fine dress, they all prep ready and there's going to be this battle. But lo and behold, the person leading this invading army, is Anicia, or Dark Anicia, as she is sometimes called.
And Anicia is the other person, the only other survivor of that slave pit which the good king found Sonja in. She was also acting as a gladiator in the court of King Baytraz, whatever, and you know, they were steel sisters. You know, they were, their bond was forged in the blood of the arena. And whilst it made Sonja into a stout, resolute hero, it broke part of Anicia, and she became twisted and fell.
I love it so much. I love the melodrama.
It's very melodramatic.
How could you, sister?
And as corny as it kind of is, you know, you're talking about, like, a speed run of the, like, Shira-Catra relationship in the Shira and the Princesses of Power. With more blood, I guess. Slightly less lesbianism. You know, you're putting that on high drive. Like, okay, let's get through this fast. An unbreakable bond of friendship. Maybe some lesbianism. They're gonna fight each other, and there's gonna be a defeat. And okay, no, they're separated. Never come back here. You've been bested, Red Sonja. Now I am Red Anicia.
Oh, it's such fun drama. And Red Sonja is banished. The good king is killed, and we lead into our next issue.
And Red Sonja has the plague.
She has the plague. She is going to die in the cold northern lands of the plague. What an ignoble death. She has to throw down her sword as well, surrender her blade, her identity.
So this comic book has a really an extraordinarily basic structure. It's, you know, the inciting incident. She's introduced to the king. He gives her a quest. They make a first attempt. Oh no, it fails. We've hit the abyss. We're at the bottom of the hero's journey. She's banished. She surrenders. Her title is taken from her. She has the plague. And then when she, you know, when she's at her lowest ebb, she has a flashback to her tragic backstory. Oh, but from there, once she's made it through, now it's time to rise back up and make the comeback and get revenge.
Are you nodding your head? Are you, like, do you not like that?
I could not. This approach is so direct, it's so standard, that I cannot have a strong emotional reaction to it one way or another. My reaction to this, the structure of this story, is a 5 out of 10. It doesn't make my heart quiver. It doesn't make me sad. It doesn't make me angry. I'm totally neutral on this.
Fair enough. For me, I think it hits a similar vein of when you're dealing with a lot of sword and sorcery fiction, it is meant to be, or I enjoy it when it is, kind of direct. It's not twists and turns that are exciting you in the plot. It's the fun of seeing that play out and seeing our hero come up against the challenge, and through her feat of impressive physical ability, or when it's really good, a little bit of wit, gets her way around, beats the impossible odds, and rides off into the sunset.
That just about happens this time. I don't think she does anything especially clever except, like, figure out the twist, which actually was a pretty good twist and pretty good moment when she did figure it out. I respected that. But, as you say, she hits her lowest point. She falls asleep in the snow from her fever. And then she has a flashback to her origins. But then she's rescued. The two bodyguards who found her in the first place, these plucky young heroines, who she keeps disrespecting and sassing off, they show up to rescue her and bring her back to the battle, saying that they found a way to cure the plague.
So over this kind of journey back, this is sort of issue 2 and 3. We get a flashback that we sort of already discussed in great detail. You know, the destruction of her home and her hunting down the guys that did it. And on her journey back, we get a few extra scenes going back to the arena. You know, we see that relationship with Anicia play out. How, you know, they were the two small, scrawny ones in the slave pit and no one ever expected anything of them. But kind of working together, they managed to stay alive. And just for kind of context here, so the bad king, Batras, doesn't matter. he is so evil. He did, like, nothing more but to sip his wine and watch his slaves fight to the death.
He is genuinely just, he's so extraordinarily evil in a mustache twirling way that is just amusing. It's just like, he does not have to have complex motivations. He's just bad. He's got an army full of monsters because they recognize that he's bad and naughty, and they're like, yeah, we'll just sign up with you, whatever. We literally couldn't care less. We just want to kill landlubbers.
Something to mention there, you mentioned landlubbers.
Yeah,
a lot of seamen.
They're
monsters
deep ones
in
from
this Hyborian
they're deep
world.
Ones from H.P. Lovecraft's canon, but drawn, like, somewhere between the monster crewmen from the Pirates of the Caribbean series with the colour palette of Bikini Bottom.
That is such a perfect explanation. They are. They're like a really bright and colourful Davy Jones's crew.
It's true. It's genuinely what they look like. And they don't, they're not even like unsettling horror monsters. And no one's surprised to see them either. Like, if this had shown up in a Conan story, Conan would be, like, freaking out and, like, being like, oh, what manner of creatures are these? They fray at my very sanity. But I'm still going to kill them with my sword. And in this, it's like, oh, yeah, that's, you know, those are the mermen. Yeah.
This kind of hits on another point of Red Sonja. So Red Sonja is a character was created from the Hyborian world, which is the same one that Conan occupies. And due to very complex licensing, I will not bore you with, Red Sonja can still be set within the Hyborian Age, but none of the characters are allowed to carry over. So we go to all the same kingdoms, but they're not allowed to have any of the same royalty. And they just like in Red Sonja to throw in these new races, creatures, often quite more atypical high fantasy.
I believe you told me once that she did meet a unicorn.
She does. In the Marvel one, she meets a unicorn. In the Red Sonja she did with the sword, she meets lion men that have wings. And in the Wrath of the Gods series, she literally meets, like, the Norse gods. She meets, like, Thor, Odin, and Loki.
She really feels like more of an Elric of Melniboné character than a Conan character.
In the sense that she just kind of travels across a multiverse. But that's where the multiverse, the Sonjaversal, comes in. There's a steampunk Red Sonja, there's a noir Red Sonja, there's samurai Red Sonja, there's hell Sonja.
Oh, come on.
They've got you covered, mate. Vampire Red Sonja, don't you forget.
Batman Who Laughs Red Sonja.
Hey, don't forget, Red Sonja meets Mars Attacks. Red Sonja meets Tarzan. Red Sonja meets Betty and Veronica from Archie Comics. These all exist. I'm not making this shit up.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, Red Sonja gets whisked away by a wizard of a modern day and she has to fight people with a modern day reincarnation of a wizard. And
yeah, that's the level. And to be fair, that's not just Dynamite running off going mad. I think even back in the Marvel days, there's a bit where Mary Jane from Spider-Man touches a magic talisman and Red Sonja takes on her body, because they both got red hair, you see, so there's a connection.
Oh yeah.
She teams up with Spider-Man. It's the way. Yeah, so the world building does have this slightly more high fantasy, and these mermen are just there and you're just expected to roll with it. And also these mermen appear in this story arc of this particular run of Red Sonja and never again ever in anything.
I've got a question. Red Sonja can appear in the Hyborian Age. She's not allowed to meet Conan characters. When is she allowed to meet Conan?
So, obviously, back when Marvel had both characters, she appeared in about 25 issues of the original Marvel Conan run. When she was at Dynamite and Dark Horse, they did two crossover series. They did Conan Red Sonja and Red Sonja Conan.
That's so confusing.
I know. Interesting enough, Jim Zub, who's writing the current Conan run for Titan, wrote that with Gail Simone. And in that crossover, it's implied that it's Red Sonja from Gail Simone's run meeting Conan during the events of Queen of the Black Coast.
So the one time where they can't be together because Conan is in a committed relationship.
Yes.
Great. A+. Whatever. I don't have enough data to form an opinion, but I do think everything Duncan has said in the last 4 minutes is quite silly.
To be fair, I always really like the fact, back in the Marvel runs, Red Sonja had her own run separate to Conan. She had two of them, but about 30 issues total. And that is all explicitly set while Conan is doing Queen of the Black Coast. So Conan's doing his piracy arc. So they're like, right, Conan's going to be out the way on the ocean, and thus Red Sonja can have the run of the continent.
I mean, that's a really convenient time for adventures, because I'm pretty sure that's when, like, the Conan RPG is set as well. It's like, do it during this time when he's not around, so he can't show up and ruin your day.
It's quite popular to either do it then or to wait until he's literally king, and then he's sort of just locked away in one palace.
But that is a good point, because he is kind of locked down, but it's also a point where a lot of the stuff that's interesting has already happened.
That is...
Like, imagine setting a Lord of the Rings RPG game during the reign of Aragorn. It's like, yeah, he solved the problems. There are a couple of orc bands out there, go sort them out. But the important issues have been resolved.
It would feel actually pretty anticlimactic. I think that's when the MMO set, though. I think, genuinely, the Age of Conan MMO, he's king in that. And you're just left to, like, mess about.
So,
Red Sonja's on her journey back, and we get a couple of interesting tidbits. We see that Anicia is literally seeing visions of the dead people that she killed while she was fighting the slave pits. And this is what's driving her down her dark path. She just keeps hearing their voices saying, you know, you did this to us. You are the fault. How dare you live while we've died? And yeah, ultimately, the real kicker, we'll only feel happy if you send more dead souls to hang out with us.
I think a really great element to the character, you know. Again, not nothing groundbreaking there, pretty standard fantasy stuff, but really serviceable to be like, yeah, this character is hounded by shame and guilt, which is manifested by, you know, the dead literally hounding them. I remember seeing something once about, and I cannot attest if it's been true because I'm literally think I'm like reciting a Tumblr post, about how there are sources which say ancient Babylonian warriors were experiencing what may be PTSD. And the doctors of a time were like, I think what's happening is the ghosts of the men you killed are still attacking you. That's why you still feel like you're in the middle of a battle. I'm going to check whether there's any source behind that. But watch this space. Okay, so I did some research into this, and it's genuinely fascinating. And it's true. It's very true. I'm quoting now from an article by Nova. Ancient Mesopotamian texts show PTSD may be as old as combat itself. Waleed Khalid Abdulhamid, an honorary senior lecturer in psychiatry at Queen Mary University of London, and Jamie Hacker-Hughes, director of the Veterans and Families Institute at Anglia Ruskin University, published their findings just last month in the journal Early Science and Medicine. Here's James Gallagher interviewing Hacker-Hughes for BBC News. The sort of symptoms after battle were very clearly what we would call now post-traumatic stress symptoms. They described hearing and seeing ghosts talking to them, who would be the ghosts of people they'd killed in battle. And that's exactly the experience of modern-day soldiers who've been involved in close hand-to-hand combat. That's the end of the quote, and that's the end of what I have to say, but I read on to this, and I had to keep digging. Until now, the oldest texts thought to reference PTSD were from the Greek historian Herodotus, who described of the Battle of Marathon in 490 BCE, in which an Athenian fighter suffers hallucination and blindness. And then I had to find the original source. So this is the Rawlinson translation of Herodotus that's referred to in this passage. There fell in this battle of Marathon on the side of the barbarians about 6,000 men and 400 men. On that of the Athenians, 192. Such was the number of slain on one side and the other. A strange prodigy likewise happened at this fight. Epizelus, a son of Cuphagoras, an Athenian, was in the thick of the fray and behaving himself as a brave man should, when suddenly he was stricken with blindness without blow of sword or dart. And this blindness continued thenceforth during the whole of his afterlife. The following is the account which he himself, as I have heard, gave of the matter. He said that a gigantic warrior, with a huge beard which shaded all of his shield, stood over against him, but the ghostly semblance passed him by, and slew the man at his side, such as I understand was the tale which Epizelus told.
Well, Geordie, that was a fun tidbit, whether or not it was true or not.
The important thing is that the division between Anicia and Red Sonja is guilt. Red Sonja is able to move past her damage. She carries the same weight, but it's affected Anicia more. She's unable to move on with her life and these dark hallucinations. And I really like that gentle line we're walking between. Is it all in Anicia's head? This is a fantasy world. We just fought some fishmen. Maybe there are ghosts. At a certain point, Red Sonja says, yes, I see them too. Is she literally seeing them too? Or is she, you know, is she lying to her friend saying, I'm just saying this to make you feel better? Or is she speaking purely metaphorically? Like, I still feel the hounding guilt of all the lives I've had to take.
And this kind of brings us towards our climax. So a couple key story points that we haven't really hit on yet. The Good King died, by the way, back when Red Sonja lost the first battle. Didn't mention that.
Yeah, we said that.
Did we? Okay, excellent. Red Sonja meets up with the King's son, a character who we haven't really mentioned because he's vaguely in the story up until this point. He's sort of established.
He genuinely appears about four times, and it's classic set-up reminder payoff. first introduction is, oh, I'm more interested in analyzing dead things. I'm a scientist. And then way later, it's like, I'm a bit of a dweeb. My dad's not proud of me. Meh. And then the payoff is he shows back up in the story, and because he is a man of science, which everyone else refers to as him being a wizard, he manages to cure the plague. He manages to get... I genuinely loved this bit, actually. A, like, 3-foot-long leech, which is the size of, like, a dachshund, to suck the disease out of Red Sonja's stomach.
It's... I don't know what I'm trying to say here. Yeah, doctors. They used to be called leeches.
Yeah, so he's like, oh, my dad was never that proud of me because I was not a warrior, but I know how to do this. I'm a clever man. Soon I will be able to cure death itself. Set up for something else later. Red Sonja is like, now I'm going to end this thing. I've been cured of my disease. I'm going to go challenge Anicia one more time, find out that Beitaz, the old king, was behind this whole thing, and challenge her to single combat.
And now we get our climax. And this is the fight scene that we mentioned earlier, where Red Sonja and Anicia duke it out. And it's about the character interaction. It's about Red Sonja not trying to beat her down, but just break through to her sort of emotionally and kind of snap her out of this sort of dark path that she's been on since they've separated 3 years ago.
And once
I like this.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, like I said before, the thing that works about this is that it's nothing groundbreaking, but it is effective storytelling. It's a very diluted version of, because it's so short, it doesn't have the build-up to it, of something you get in, like, the She-Ra cartoon. It's like, okay, well, that was, like, this done over 5 seasons. There's a lot of emotional weight to it. There's a lot of anticipation. There's a lot of seeing these characters develop over time and come to a conclusion. This is 5 issues.
Let me just comment on the She-Ra cartoon for a moment. Because really, I've watched that entire show.
Yeah.
And I love that show.
Yeah.
And I know I love that show. Because I don't watch 5 seasons of anything unless I'm clearly loving it. There's so much stuff out there that I don't put near the time I put into She-Ra.
Genuinely, but a really good show. Just, there's nothing else to it. A real inheritor to something like Teen Titans from back in the day.
Just exactly, but I will just say this. Did you ever feel like you just wanted the moment where the animation just went up one more notch?
I don't trouble myself with such thoughts.
Fine. Great character work, but I was always there waiting for, like, the moment where the fighting, like, really looked good, and it never quite clinched it. And
fair
I don't
enough.
Know why. I was always, like, hanging on for this moment that didn't come. Anyway, not my disappointment. Great show. We do recommend. That's an official Is This a Fantasy podcast recommendation. Check it out.
Yeah, that's a thing we do. Okay. Anicia breaks down in this fight because she starts to realize that Beitaz was behind the whole thing. Because Beitaz reveals, you know, he's this sadistic character. He loves inflicting pain, physical and emotional. And he's gloating, saying, there never was a plague. It was always a poison. You quarantined this city and to let them all die by the plague, but no one's died. And the entire army was wiped out, not by disease, but by a poison. The king was killed. And Sonja was cured from a poison, not a disease. And that leads Anicia to break down, because this whole time she thought that she was expunging a sickness. She was stopping a plague from spreading by killing city after city of people. But she was manipulated. And of course, when you reveal to your number one henchperson that actually they've been your stooge, not your henchman this whole time, they turn against you. Oh no, King Beitaz, you really didn't think this through.
Classic. Like, this guy is Dr. Evil. This guy is perfectly stupidly evil. And it's like this moment, this is one of the things that's like, dude, you couldn't just wait to, like...
You're winning!
Kill her first, like, let her kill Sonja, then get a guy to shoot her in the back, then do the gloat.
Tell your guys to shoot a bunch of arrows at her, which is ultimately the thing that will, like, slowly kill her, but you chose to gloat first. Anyway, classic. Everyone learn from this lesson. Gloat second, kill first. I'm going to write that on my wall. I'm actually going to write it on the ceiling above my bed so I never forget it. And I look at it every night.
Well, I fear for anyone that spends the night with you, waking up in the morning and seeing those words. So, Rezonia and Nicia, they go for him, and it's the fight. All the guards are in the way, but they're hacking it through. It's impossible. How could they nearly make it to the evil king? He attempts to flee, and then we get some extra payoff, because more guards are coming. He's like, aha, my reinforcements are here at last. I shall still win the battle. The orcs are lined up waiting for the pirates from the coast to come to Minas Tirith. But it is not the reinforcements. In fact, it is the two bodyguards Red Sonja has been speaking down to and some other people. And they come in and go, haha, we have thwarted you this time.
It is the same payoff as the Three Amigos, yes.
And obviously, Red Sonja does a, I was wrong to chastise you. You have every hope to being great warriors. And they capture the king.
They capture the king. They're going to take him ransom, and Nissi is going to kill him, but no need. It turns out he was already turbo poisoned by a woman who he's enslaved, who's getting her own back. It's, you know, it's all about Gersimer delivering, like, poetic justice. You know, this woman he's abused and subjugated and humiliated gets the last laugh, and he doesn't have to be killed by the sword. He's undone by his own machinations, you know. Really just, again, classic stuff. Nicia, at first you think she's dying, but then it's like, oh no, she's kind of fine. She's been shot by a lot of arrows,
right?
But she's fine.
This bothered the hell out of me. So this is the very end of this trade paperback, right at the end of the story. We see Nicia filled with arrows, lying flat on the ground. And then we leave her to deal with the king. And then when we cut back to her, she is fine. And I'm like, there needed to be something. Even if it was just her, like, half staggering up for a panel, pulling an arrow out, I would have taken it. But it is nothing. It is just cut back, and it's like, half the arrows have disappeared, and she's fine now.
Yeah. And the reason why she's fine now is so that her life can be tragically cut short. It can't be the death of Boromir, where it's like, on one hand, you failed because you gave in to temptation, you gave in to evil, and that's wrong. You died in a last heroic gasp. You know, you did your very best, though it was fruitless until the very end. And in some ways, despite the fact you failed, that's still commendable. But that's not why. It's because the prince, the son of the good king, sneaks up behind her and stabs her in the throat. And is like, I did it! I'm finally a great warrior! I've avenged my father!
This comes out of nowhere. This guy isn't even established to be in the scene.
Mm-mm.
There's literally one panel at the end of a page of, like, this shadowy feature behind Anicia. And then the next panel of this guy stabbing her in the throat. And it gave me the biggest whiplash of, like, where were you?
Right.
We've literally had panel after panel of establishing this arena we're in.
And here's the interesting
thing
about...
You're not here.
Here's the interesting thing. So, on one hand, the emotions of this scene, it really tells me more that this is about his foolishness. You know, he's, all this time, he's rejected being a warrior, and that meant his father was never proud of him. Now he's doing this in order to make his late father proud of him by proving he's a warrior, by doing something which is ultimately craven and doesn't prove his courage at all because he stabbed someone who wasn't looking. But then that kind of gets completely inverted because it's immediately revealed by Red Sonja in what I think is genuinely a pretty good twist, where she says, I've just learned that the plague wasn't a plague at all, it was a poison. Now, who has the ability to create such a virulent poison? And who has the ability to cure that poison? And who had the ability to poison me at that party I was at? It's you! You, Prince, betrayed your father, the good king! All that's happened was because of you! And he's like, I didn't mean for any of this to happen. My dad wasn't very nice to me, and Beatrice says that he'd be nicer to me. And then she kills him.
I'll be honest with you, Geordie. I think this is such a bit of a limp ending. It's done so quickly, and also it's a good twist. I'm not gonna, the reveal that he was the one poisoning behind it, I'm like, yes, that's a cool idea.
It makes a lot of sense.
I didn't think this landed emotionally.
I agree it doesn't land emotionally because essentially too much is happening in the last section. If Anicia bled to death, and Red Sonja is left in a funk where it's like Anicia destroyed herself because of her rage and because she was deceived. And then she turns to the prince and says, I too have been deceived. I'm sharing in Anicia's torments because, like her, I have been used for someone else's end, and it's your fault. And if at that point she was able to turn on him and kill him and say, I know what you did, I feel like that makes a lot more sense from a storytelling point of view, and it makes a lot more sense from the emotions of the characters. You know, this kid, he's killing this woman with her back is turned in order to get his dad to approve of him. But he obviously didn't care that much about his father approving of him because he killed him. Surely you'd want it to be like, oh, I've rejected my father utterly, and I did this purely for the sake of achieving power.
And it plays into what he said earlier. He said earlier, you know, if I can develop my technologies, I could cure death. You know, this is someone who justifies to himself the idea of, I know what I'm doing now is horrible, but if I can gain power, I can do great good. Like, it felt like it was lined up.
Right. And that doesn't have anything to do with killing Anicia. What it should completely hone in on is, I need to be in charge because I'm great, because I can change the world. And it gives a far greater emotional stake to Red Sonja to be like, should I kill this person for having done an evil deed when he could benefit the world? But if she just kills him because it's like, you killed my best buddy and now I have to kill you because I'm angry at you, there's less emotional conflict there. It's just cut and dried. I'm doing this because I want to, as opposed to, I genuinely can see the benefit, and yet I feel I must kill you because you're awful.
It's weird to get this far in, and this was the moment for me, like a fan, to go, ah, oh, Gale, I think you just didn't quite nail that. And we are really talking about the last three pages. Yep. All of this plays out so incredibly quickly. So this character is then, the prince is killed by Red Sonja, and obviously the two bodyguards are like, but who shall rule the land now? And Red Sonja is like, why? You two!
She immediately declares herself regent. Like, in that moment, she's like, and I am now regent. And my first act of regents is to pass on my regency to you two.
I hope they do well. Their kingdom, that is, has no standing army, racked by plague. It's basically one city-state at this point.
Yeah, and the great news is that it will definitely be a part of the canon going forward. You know, these adventures will never be neglected or forgotten. We're not going to do anything to radically change Red Sonja's backstory or decide, you know, or put her in a radically different location so she never has to think about these people again. It's always going to be a part of the great tapestry of Red Sonja.
Perhaps. It's just not what the character is, Geordi, and it's something that, as a fan, I've had to come to terms with the fact that you've just got to be able to roll moment to moment. And something that I enjoy about Red Sonja, it's not because I think Red Sonja needs to be put on that massive pedestal. I'm not excited for the film because I think it's going to be good, per se. Red Sonja has always filled this void for me as this secondary tier of like the sword and sorcery genre. That is really fun because it doesn't take itself too serious. No. It lets lots of melodramatic scenes play out. If you don't take it seriously, you can really roll from just one fun event to one fun event. And because it's just so ubiquitous, because there's just so much of it, it's that sort of, it's nice to be able to always dip into something. And that's kind of, I always kind of come back like, oh, I just want a bit of sword and sorcery. What sword and sorcery is on the table? Oh, Red Sonja. Okay, let's give the newest interpretation a go. That said though, Geordi, when it's all said and done, what are your concluding thoughts about this introduction to Red Sonja I've just given you?
I probably enjoyed us talking about it more than I did reading it. I think my interpretation of it has gone up in the process of discussing it, as I sort of reckon with, it's a very simple story, told pretty well, pretty effectively, pretty utilitarian-y. I'm glad that I didn't pay any money for it. That definitely enhanced my experience. And the fact that I know I won't have to pay money for the next part makes me think that, yeah, I probably will go ahead and just, like, dip into it, just check out what happens next. I got nothing wrong with that.
I've got to tell you now, I do really like the next arc of this. I actually think it's better than Queen of Plagues. It's this really fun one where she gets... I'm just going to tell you the premise now, if people are curious. Because that's also what First Sonya is like. It's like, was that amazing? No. Was it good enough to get you to read the next one? Probably. In the next arc, she gets hired by this guy who's dying, and he wants to just throw one massive great party before he goes.
Okay.
And he literally charges Red Sonya to just track down all the great artisans, so the best cook, the best actor, the best fencer. Like, he just wants to get all these great people in a room for one big party, and that's the plot, the next section.
That sounds pretty good. I actually like the sound of that. All that is to say, it's fine. It's pretty good. Yeah, I can't complain in the slightest. If you got Kindle Unlimited, go for it. I mean, what's the worst that could happen? I enjoy the fact that at no point in the story does anyone even mention the fact she's wearing a chainmail bikini. Not even once. No one gets to mention it. No one even makes a joke about it. They're just like, it doesn't even seem to cross anyone's mind. That's good fun. Just embrace that silly aspect.
Well, I think that's the exact attitude I was hoping you kind of would take away from experiencing Red Sonya.
And more importantly... Sorry, Duncan, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No.
More importantly, she probably is my favourite Conan-adjacent heroine that I've come across in my time reading Conan stories. I have never liked Baylet that much. I've just never liked her. Valeria is fun, but a pretty misogynistic caricature. And that Red Sonya clone from the very early parts of the Dark Horse run on Conan, where it's so over the top and so edgy, is just abhorrent to me. So seeing where she's like come from, what she's been like bastardized from, definitely prefer Red Sonya to whatever that is.
I think that's a really good shout. And I think, as you said, it's that chainmail bikini in so many ways sums up the character. And I don't think it defines the character. This is a character that does stand apart from sort of a sense of like sex appeal. It's not that the chainmail bikini represents. It represents just the silliness don't think too hard.
It definitely represents that in this run. I'm going to go out on a limb, a slightly uninformed limb, and say, Duncan, that I rather imagine the chainmail bikini probably had a little bit more to do with sex appeal when Roy Thomas was making it in the 70s.
I am not going to deny that potential interpretation.
What did you make of this story, Duncan?
I make of this story... That's a very good question. I'll tell you now, Geordie, this isn't necessarily my absolute favourite Red Sonya story. In fact,
you did just say the next one's better.
Yeah, the next one, I think the next one's better. In fact, it's not even my favourite interpretation of this character per se. I actually think that, like, Mark Russell wrote Red Sonya, Gail Simone's version is volume 2, Mark Russell is like volume 5. Volumes means like soft rebooted runs rather than literal trade paperback volumes, just how it's called. Where she's in like a royalty position, not to be confused with Queen Sonya. Different run entirely. These are all these different aspects. Why I often look to Queen of Plagues is I think Queen of Plagues is quite direct and quite... This is a sword and sorcery heroine. It's not She Devil with the Sword, which is sort of a bit more high fantasy. It's not Amy Chu's Red Sonya, but in the modern day. And it's not Mark Russell's brilliant, but, you know, a bit of a spin on it, Red Sonya, but she's now in charge of a nation. This is just Red Sonya on a mission.
Is that the one where she's defending Hyrcania from the overwhelming, like, threat of outside invasion from Kitai, maybe?
Yes, it is.
Okay, that's the other one I've read. I've only read one Gail Simone story. I thought that one was Gail Simone as well.
So Gail Simone has written this 18-issue run, collected into Queen of Plagues, The Art of Blood and Fire, and the final volume, The Forgiving of Monsters.
Okay, so not that much, actually.
No, but hugely influential in taking the character, not necessarily taking the character into a new direction that other writers pulled on, But I think Gail Simone establishes the habit of reinterpreting the character. And that's why I think this is quite a nice starting place. So this is Red Sonja branching out. If you want to go back to more classic Red Sonja, be my guest. Just be prepared for either old style 70s comic, you know, that. People who like 70s comics are a niche in and of themselves. Or you want early 2000s, dear God, what is this colouring? My eyes, my eyes. But still some high fantasy cheese.
There were some anti-recommendations there. Do you have any recommendations for old school Red Sonja?
Oh, that's a very good question. Old school Red Sonja, I actually think her appearances in the original Conan the Barbarian comic, where she was created, are really fun to experience. She's in about 25 different issues of that run, spread out over 270 issues. Good luck. And I also recommend Eric Trautmann's run, which is issue 51 to 75 of Red Sonja, She-Devil with the Sword. It's a bit weird. They hadn't quite come up with the reboot idea. So Eric Trautmann's run is sort of hidden at the back of Michael Oeming's run, which went for about 50 issues. And then after his run, they went, guys, let's just start doing soft reboots, because no one knows that this killer run is hidden here. So that's great stuff. Genuinely though, if it's Red Sonja and it's issue one, you can just start with it. It is that disconnected. You're not going to have a problem.
Now, Duncan, I only have two things to cover before we wrap up this episode, and we all are so quivering with excitement about the upcoming movie release, which might actually release on the same day as this episode should come out. So that's serendipity right there. Duncan, all-important question. With Conan's three main paramours, okay, fine, four if you include Zenobia. I guess you can include Zenobia if you want, even though she has the personality of a celery stick. Snog, marry, avoid. The three main Conan paramours.
Okay. That is quite the question. So obviously Vaylet from the Queen of the Black Coast story, Valeria from Red Nails, also talked about on the podcast, mm-hmm. and Red Sonja. Oh, this is a tough one. This is a bit of a hard one also, because it's like all these characters have slightly different versions. Well, not Valeria. She's only really in one thing. But like Baylet, it's quite hard, because there's Baylet as in original Robert E. Howard, and then there's Marvel Baylet, a little bit softer and rounder at the edges, and then there's Dark Horse Baylet, which is, I don't even actually want to comment on what madness is going on with that characterization. Oh, okay. Snog, marry, avoid.
And for those of you who may not have heard this version, this is the slightly tamer version of Fuck, Marry, Kill. But we're using a nice one.
I'm going to have to go. I'm going to avoid Valeria, because I think she's just a bit dull for her, even in her own story. There's not as much of a character. Nothing but a quick snog with Baylet, because she is genuinely kind of frightening. And then it would have to be married to Red Sonja, because she's the only one I actually trust is probably a good person, like down to her core, and would defend me in the horrendous world that is the Hyborian Age.
That's fair.
She's also a redhead.
Yes, that's a major. You're right. That's a major factor in her favour. I'm going to swap it around a little bit. I'm going to snog Valeria because she's hot. I'm going to avoid Baylet because I have never really enjoyed her character in any version. I don't understand why people are so attached to Queen of the Black Coast. I don't find her especially compelling. Granted, I haven't read the Marvel version, which you're obsessed with, Duncan. However, I'll avoid her, which leads me to marry Red Sonja. For the same reasons as you. She seems like a good person. The only one of them who's actually a good person. And, she's a redhead, which is great.
I'm glad we've got our preferences out there nice and clear. I have nothing more to add to that.
No, that was good.
Other than the fact that I don't think either of our partners are redheads, so let's hope they don't listen to this one.
Actually, mine was for a bit, because last year for Halloween, we went as Mulder and Scully.
Who went who?
Mulder and Scully from The X-Files.
I have never seen The X-Files.
Well, you know what David Duchovny looks like, and you know that he and I are like twins. We're spitting images of each other.
No, absolutely. I can picture it now. I think I must have seen a photo, actually. I don't know why I'm saying, oh, what was this like? Definitely showed me a photo at the time.
Now, final thing, Duncan. Final thing before we move on to the choice of next time. I feel like we should do a tiny bit of story time, as we often do on episodes where we talk about Conan, because you included Red Sonja in the very storied Conan, but Conan in an Age Undream of RPG that you ran many years ago.
That I did. Oh, thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about your approach and how you brought her in, what your move was there?
Yes. So I ran an RPG for Geordie and friends. And in that, we were doing a setting where we were in Tehran. And we were dealing with a siege in the city of Makalet, which was on the eastern coast of the Velet Sea. And our characters had infiltrated the city, and it was under siege from the external forces. And the city was mounting this like final defence from this grand empire. In many ways, like how Vienna defended itself from the onslaughting siege of the Ottoman Empire in 1529. So I thought this would be a great occasion to drop in a version of Red Sonja as one of the mercenaries hired to defend the siege that the character could interact with. It was inspired sort of by the original story, but mostly because this is the same way that Roy Thomas originally introduced the character to Conan. The Siege of Makalet is an event between issues 18 to 26 of the original Conan the Barbarian comic book, and it's where Red Sonja is first introduced in issue 23, Shadow of the Vulture, which I do own. Just to mention, original issue there.
Shocking.
I know. No, what was shocking, mate, is that I was in the shop and I mentioned to the bloke at the till, oh, do you know this is the first appearance of Red Sonja? And he marked up the price on the spot. Fucking bastard. He just went, oh, sorry, our policy is that all first appearances are this price. I was like, you didn't know, you twat.
That's fucking amazing. I'm writing it on the ceiling right now. Never tell shopkeepers interesting stuff about their products. The reason why I invited you to bring that up, Duncan, is I wanted to sort of hone in on the way in which you sort of, I think, used this opportunity to kind of just like kick me in the nuts at the time. You did this little adventure after a tiny little time skip that happened after the end of our previous adventure. Classic for like a Conan story to jump ahead in time. Now, for those who've listened to our Conan fanfiction empire history episode, will hear one of my favorite ever RPG stories to tell, which is about how I screwed up amazingly and accidentally executed an innocent princess who had done absolutely nothing wrong. And my character, Beowulf, was genuinely traumatized by this. And like, in between adventures, I told Duncan that my character had taken an oath that he would never harm another woman as long as he lived. And so, as I'm storming up a siege ladder to attack a city for like someone I'm sworn I've been promised that I'll do this. I arrive at the top and Red Sonja is waiting for me there with a sword, being like, "Hello again, Beowulf. It's time for us to fight." And I'm like, "I literally can't hurt you. This is not fair."
It was the most perfect fall into my lap as a GM I've ever had. I was so delighted.
Well done, Duncan.
Oh, I was like the Evil King in that moment, just watching your anguish.
It was a great moment. My solution to that, for the record, was I turned around and I smashed the siege ladder I'd come up and just changed sides on the spot.
It was really, I think you literally just kind of turned around and pushed the siege ladder with other men coming up just off the battlements. And you were like, okay, I'm with you guys now.
good times. That was a good session. I think that was genuinely the last session ever.
It was. It was a very short-lived Conan campaign. I would love to still take you back to that setting, Geordie.
Now then, let's move on, shall we?
Let's. To the future.
Okay, Geordie, Duncan, so... Oh.
I'm going to spend one of my destiny tokens, is that what we call them? Our little mechanic,
I didn't even get to pick.
Pick of a book.
All right.
No, you didn't even get announced what it was going to be. In many respects, Jordy, I could be shooting myself in the foot because you could have, by some weird coincidence, about to pick the very book, I might just say.
I've got one in mind now, so maybe it'll all line up. But yes, I think this is your first time ever using one of your many destiny tokens. Oh boy, I'm viewing the one who's abused them up till now.
Because Geordie, you say to me, why are we reading a comic? Why can't we read a prose story? That's where the real literature is. Well, Geordie, so that's what you think. That's what you get, my friend. Because we're staying on this Red Sonja train just for one more week, for one more episode.
Wow.
Gail Simone wrote a prose novel.
You got me. No, that's very great. Sure, that makes sense. I'm fine with that. We'll stay on this train.
So, for people that don't know, I'm talking about Gail Simone's Red Sonja Consumed, a novel that was released, I believe, last year in 2024, and the first prose Red Sonja novel in close to 30-odd years. Gail Simone's first ever prose novel. And yeah, let's see what she does with this character when we're not trying to do a story arc in, as Geordie said at the start, 100 pages of comic panels. Let's actually have a book. Let's see what more dimension can be added here.
Well, there's no one I was going to pick, and I guess we'll have to find out what my pick was next time in a month. I can't. Are you going to pick again after this, or is it go back to my turn?
No, it goes back to you. Don't you worry, sir.
All right. I have no idea where I can get my hands on Red Sonja Consumed. I doubt it's going to be on Audible, so we're going to have to see.
Well, best of luck with that. If you've been listening along and you have ever experienced Red Sonja, or have maybe been inspired to give the character a go, based on what we said, hell, maybe you've only experienced was the like 1980s movie that Arnold Schwarzenegger apparently only shows to his kids when they were naughty, let us know your thoughts. The best place, as always, is the Is This Just Fantasy podcast on Instagram, where we give regular updates on episode releases for the podcast and additional reviews. I put one out a while ago for Till Death Do Us Part. Go and check it out. You can also catch us on Blue Sky at Just Fantasy. And also, if you want to send a bit more of an in-depth message, there's always our Gmail, isthisfantasypodcast@gmail.com. We absolutely adore from here for you. It makes our days. I show the message to Geordie. He sends back smiley faces and emojis. It's all good.
One more thing I'll say about the podcast right now is we had a very exciting development, which is that listenership has now increased enough that we've got our first people saying, hey, would you like to run ads on the show? And Duncan and I have decided internally that for the time being, we're not going to do that. We know that, you know, we're cultivating a small but hopefully quite passionate audience, and we don't really want to waste your guys' time. You know, you do us a great credit by giving us the time for you to listen to us and appreciate the show, and we kind of want to respect that by not hounding your ears with, as of yet, I'm sure, completely excellent mattresses and cooking services and VPN services, which may be illegal in our country pretty soon anyway.
But if you do want to just show that appreciation, one way that always helps is to just give us a positive review on your platform of choice. 5 stars on Spotify just means that the algorithm will recommend us to more and more people and they can join into our community.
I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol.
So long.
Bye.